Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm editor Candace Gibson, joined by staff writer Jane McGrath.
Hey, Candace.
I think chivalry is alive and well, and we have the knights of Middle Age and medieval Europe to thank for that.
That's right. And I guess when we're young, we think about, I guess the little girls at least, think about meeting knights in shining armor. And we don't really know a lot, except for, you know, the little that we get in history class, about what actual knights in the Middle Ages were like.
And whether or not their armor was in fact shiny. And after doing a little bit of research, I'm inclined to think it may have been, you know, buffed and polished, but I don't think it was that shiny.
Yeah, probably not if they were busy in battle and didn't get to clean it that often.
They've got a lot going on. They've got their squires, sure, but I think we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah.
So knights, it's not just the stuff of literature. They were real medieval warriors, and they began their military training very young. And the word knight actually comes from the Anglo-Saxon term for boy. And knighthood and the system of becoming a knight actually began under the feudal system, which was established by Charlemagne in the 8th century.
That's right. And knights, especially early on, but later not necessarily, they had land that they held from that lords would sort of lease to them, and they were responsible for. In order to get dubbed a knight, usually you were the son of a knight or a lord. And so they weren't necessarily nobility per se, but they were pretty respected, and especially when we talk about the code of chivalry that we will in a second, just the idea that they were respected people. And you know, if you ever read Canterbury Tales, like most people do in high school, the prologue actually lists the knight first because he was so respected.
Right. And part of the reason for that was that it was not a position that you inherited. It was something that you had to work for.
You earned.
And just to give you a little bit of background on knighthood and the reason that knights were so important, during Charlemagne's reign, essentially, there was a bunch of land. And after the Roman Empire fell, Western Europe essentially had no countries and no real organization, just huge parcels of land. And there was a lot of fighting over territories, but there was nothing really productive in place to control them and to really ration it out and to give order and to create agricultural mainstays. And so Charlemagne instituted feudalism. And he had this patch of land that sort of went from northern Spain to Italy and then France and Germany and Poland. And he would dole out portions of land to nobles, and in exchange, they would agree to be loyal to him and to offer him protection. Or he could give land to knights in exchange for their military service. And knights who lived on land really had a good deal going, whether they lived on land owned by the king or by a noble, in exchange for food, clothing, and shelter. They would, you know, provide military service when it was necessary, and they also protected the serfs who were underneath them, as well as the men who were over them. And the serfs were important because these were the people who were growing the food that fed them.
Yeah.
So in lieu of having an actual centralized government, this was a pretty good system, and everyone was taken care of. So knighthood was important, and you really did feel like you were part of a bigger structure and that you were important to your land or your fief.
That's right. And knights actually made out pretty well. I guess we're going to talk about that later with the terms in terms of the Knights Templar. But actually, one thing that struck me was that even though knights are known as professional warriors, there was this thing called scutage where knights could actually send out others to do their fighting for them. I guess they were just too happy back in Europe with their lands that they were running and making a pretty good living at. But if you want to go back to how boys became knights, it actually started about the age of 7. Beforehand, they would be raised by their moms in the household, but by the age of 7, they officially became a page. They would learn horsemanship, reading, writing, religion, even falconry, which was popular at the time.
Yeah, so they got their hunting skills, they got all their schooling skills down, and it was sort of cute. I'm sure it wasn't exactly cute back then, but it's cute to me to read about it. They would use wooden swords and lances to practice combat, so
yeah.
Isn't that just kind of adorable, a little page?
Yeah.
Page, little cute little page boy haircut out there with his wooden sword. And he's going to be a big, strong knight one day.
Sure.
I think it's sweet. Anyway, once they turned 14, the page became an esquire or squire. And in order to mark this passage, there was a religious ceremony, and he would take a consecrated sword, and he would promise to use it for honorable purposes. And this is all very sword in the stone to me. You know, I can see this happening. Little wart and taking his sword from the stone.
And the squire is actually, I'm such a literary geek, but the squire is actually the second one, I believe, listed in the Canterbury Tales prologue. And it just goes to show how system of the page to the squire to the knight was very respected.
Yeah, and very much instilled in the common mentality and how people conceived of the order of their lands. So the squire had a couple of different types of positions that he could fill during his training. And in addition to these positions, he was learning social etiquette and behavior as well as martial arts. And I've got to tell you guys about these positions because they tickle me. A couple in particular. There was a squire of body who was a personal servant to a knight or a lady. The squire of the chamber, also the chamberlain was another name for that, and he attended to the rooms in a castle. This is one of my favorites. The table or carving squire was in charge of carving meat and waiting on banquet tables. So really sort of a waiter is what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of sort of the fraternity hazing sort of situation.
Yes, I'll have to ask Stuart about that one later.
Oh, okay.
Squire of wines, who managed the wine cellar. Not a bad position, at least to me. Let's see. Squire of pantry, who stocked the pantry, managed supplies for the home. Squire of arms, who maintained armor and weapons. And the squire of honor, who helped in ceremonies and feasts. And if you're like me, you're thinking that some sound a little bit more prestigious than others. So I'm wondering, honestly, if there was some sort of ranking system or depending on how well they performed as pages that determined whether they got to be a squire of body or a meat squire.
Yeah, that's true. Although I think no matter what position you were at, you were kind of can't wait until you turned 21. And at the time, it wasn't about alcohol, but about being dubbed a knight. This was about the time that you would. Sometimes, actually, squires, if there was a war going on and they went to go fight, they would serve their knight in battle. And if they did something particularly heroic, they could be actually dubbed on the battlefield. But usually, once a knight turned 21 back at home, they would be dubbed officially in sort of this elaborate ceremony. It often accompanied another big ceremony, like a wedding.
Or even, I think, Christmas or Easter or sure. another big feast day.
Yeah, and so it would be a major part of it. And you can tell by the fact that they had this ritual they went through. The night before, the boy would go have a ritual bath. They would have an all-night prayer vigil. And then the next day, when they went to go get dubbed, they would have to swear this oath. Where they were devoted to the church, they were loyal to their lord, they defended a lady, et cetera, et cetera.
And some of these other et ceteras, again, it's just so fun reading about knight history, you know, whether you were a meat squire or whatever. Parts of this oath were really humorous, or at least to me today. They had to, in addition to defending ladies and being loyal to their lord and to the church, they had to be brave. They had to promise that they were going to take off their armor only when they were sleeping. And they would vow never to avoid danger because they were afraid. They had to be on time, which is just good sense, really. And another one is that whenever the knight returned home, he would have to share and tell about his escapades. And talk about being a literary geek. This got the wheels in my mind turning. I was like, huh, well, I wonder if this is why the, you know, oral tradition of knight stories is so alive and well. There must have been a lot of knight stories going around if you were required to tell someone about it.
Yeah, and another one I found interesting, actually, in the little details, was that if a knight was taken prisoner, he would have to surrender peaceably after he was really taken, and he wouldn't be allowed to fight his captors again until he got their permission, which I found really interesting. You would expect, you know, if you were taken prisoner, that you would try your best to fight your way out of
it.
But there's an interesting code this oath that they had to take.
And you can imagine if every single knight is good enough to uphold the code, then things must have been, you know, pretty chivalrous around there, and people must have, you know, been really proper and kind to one another. But it seems like every now and then there's a bad apple that gets through, and bad knights must have come along and done things like stolen another's armor or challenged him to a duel, and it was sort of 2-on-1 instead of, you know, 1-on-1 as the action was supposed to be.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, most people associate this whole oath with what is now known as chivalry. I mean, if you don't sort of just talk about how opening up a car door is chivalrous. But actually, the term originally came back to just meaning good horsemanship, which I found really interesting. Another source I found said that it meant just plain tenure of land at all. And that sort of made sense to me in terms of the word gentleman, which, you know, has a similar evolution in how we think of it today. You know, gentlemen are people who open doors for ladies. But back then, a gentleman was just sort of someone who owned land or property. So it's just interesting to look at the evolution of what these terms mean today and what they meant back then.
Definitely. I think that the etymology of the words definitely sheds light on what the knights did and how the tradition continues today, even though there aren't exactly medieval warriors prancing around modern-day England. But at this point, the knight was officially called a sir, and he could own land and hire his own soldiers. And you may be wondering, well, what did a knight do when there weren't any battles to fight in? And the answer is pretty simple. They participated in tournaments so that their skills didn't go to waste.
And that's right. And one of my favorite, I think, is joust.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I'm from Maryland, in case you didn't know, and jousting is actually our official sport. I don't know how that happened, but it's very bizarre. But, I mean, I love it. And jousting, if you've ever seen something like A Knight's Tale, obviously, with Heath Ledger, it was a one-on-one thing where knights would go up against each other mounted on horses, and they would basically rush at each other with long, dull-headed lances. And so they would keep them out in front of them so that they would try to hit the other person as they went by. And you win about three lances, and you would get points based on if you broke your lance on the other person, where it hit, etc. And after three lances, they would get off and start fighting if they wanted to, with swords, actually.
And the church, I guess, was okay with jousting because it was not quite as dangerous as another popular tournament, and that was the melee. And that was sort of a free-for-all battle. Imagine a really big group of knights, and you're in this big huddle of knights, and you eyeball a competitor. You choose one other person, you start fighting. Once you defeat that person, he's down. Either he's down dead or he's down passed out. You move on to the next person. So it's a one-on-one fight, but in the context of a larger group, and the premise is last man standing wins. And the church really did not like this one because a lot of people really did die. And it just, you know, for the sake of entertainment, it just seemed rather controversial. So, and also, you know, from my modern perspective, it doesn't seem very chivalrous to perform like this in front of a lady you were trying to impress by killing other people. But alas, I have an anachronistic point of view, so.
I can see that. Although, one advantage to fighting these games is that you could make a lot of money. That was one motivation that they had, in addition to, like, getting honor and practicing your skills. But they could actually get money by the fact that, at least in jousting, when someone lost, they had to turn over their horse and their armor to the winner. And they could buy back those things from the winner. And so if you were a common winner, you were good at jousting, you could make a good load of money.
And that was good news because all of your knightly accoutrements were rather expensive, particularly armor. And when armor originated, it was back in ancient Rome, and they actually used leather. And leather was very expensive to use, you know, as a full body protective covering, but it was malleable. So it was really cool because you could shape it and then you boil it in water or oil and it hardens in place. And you've got something that's very resistant to all sorts of points and tips and piercings coming at you. And so the middle-aged knights used leather as armor, and then it continued to evolve into chainmail, for instance. That was another Roman idea originally, and these were small interwoven steel rings, and there were two predominant types. One was butted mail, where the rings were really, really close together, and the other was riveted mail, where the rings were actually connected with rivets. And this was cheaper than armor, but unlike armor and leather armor, it was really vulnerable to piercings, and it was pretty heavy, too. And it's funny to look back at part of the training for becoming a knight was that you would practice walking around wearing chainmail so your body could get used to the weight. Sort of like today, I think that there are some military personnel who train with their backpacks on and their gear. Or even if you're going to hike the Appalachian Trail, you practice walking around with your pack so you get used to the weight.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's interesting to see how armor changes as weapons change, as they advance, because, you know, you look at leather and chainmail, like you were saying, Candace, and they are, you know, they do protect against cuts and scrapes, but when, you know, people started developing crossbows, for instance, this would not protect them, and so they had to start turning to more solid metal pieces of armor. And so, you know, these solid metal pieces, they're so difficult sometimes. I heard that they weighed up to 60 pounds. They were super hot. They would often take an hour to put on, need help to do that on top of it. As weapons advanced even further, you see the introduction of gunpowder. They finally made its way from Asia to Europe. And once that was introduced, it was like, what's the point anymore?
Yeah. Armor's a moot point then.
Yeah.
But the funny thing about armor, too, is that it really didn't protect your entire body. So you had to wear chainmail, especially in places like your underarms and where your joints came together, like your knees, so that you had some protection there because the plates didn't fit that tightly. And contrary to popular belief, it wasn't too hard to move around in. Like, you weren't stiff. It was just really heavy. That would have been the challenge.
I can see that, yeah.
And so knights continued to serve, you know, throughout the Middle Ages and throughout medieval Europe, you know, under the feudal system. And then they actually served a more, I guess, national or international, really, since Europe at this point was breaking apart into different nations, purpose, and that was protecting pilgrims who were traveling to the Holy Land during the Crusades and caring for sick pilgrims. And these are groups like the Knights Templar and the Knights Hospitallers and the Teutonic Knights. These still exist today as charitable societies.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the most beloved orders of knights was actually the Templar, as Candace mentioned. And this is one, unlike the others, that doesn't exist today. And it was a really interesting story because they were beloved at the time. To give you some background on it, they were founded about the 1100s, like you said, to protect pilgrims going to the Holy Land at the time. And if you listen to our Crusades podcast, you know more about why they were doing that. So what was interesting about this order and other orders like it was that it was both a military sort of purpose, and they were religious men. It was basically a religious order where they were monks, and they were supposed to live a modest life, and they didn't always do that. They like other orders, got proud and greedy, and so there was lots of controversy around them all the time. But this particular order got accused in the early 14th century, I believe, of lots of abuses in terms of both monetary abuses, like they were mishandling charity that they got, et cetera, et cetera. But people were also upset that they were heretics, that they weren't holding mass correctly, that they were actually worshiping idols, and there was homosexual behavior going on between them as well, which the church would not have liked. So at this time, it was actually the King Philip IV of France who really had had his eye out on them and wanted them to be taken out. And recent documents released by the Vatican, actually a couple years ago, it's very interesting, show that the Pope at the time actually absolved them of their charges, and he didn't believe that they were heretics, but the King Philip of France supposedly owed them a lot of money, and that's really why he wanted the whole order gone. And so they were tried, they were tortured, and they were eventually burned at the stake. And it's really sad, mysterious story.
Yeah, that is, it's really haunting, especially if you think about all the hard work that goes into becoming a knight, and mm-hmm. you know how you do vow to uphold this oath. And I'm sure that once you sort of develop into your own separate order of knights, you have an entirely different code of ethics that you're also upholding. So it seems like you would have to be really committed to uphold all of these principles. And I'm sure it must have been very hard on the group when they were taken apart, and, you know, even harder when they were executed.
Yeah.
But that's another point. So today, if you're not a member of one of the charity groups that originated in these different orders of knights, you might be able to attain knighthood by two different means, one of which is a martial arts achievement. And almost like if you were to practice karate or another form of martial arts that originated in Asia, you'd be given different colors of belts for the level
sure.
of martial arts that you attain. And the same is true in different schools around England, where and around other parts of Europe too, where you can earn recognition for demonstrations, and you may be asked to perform at different fairs and festivals to show your prowess. And the other way you can become a knight is a member of royalty bestows that honor upon you. And it's so fun to see the different people who come up for knighthood, be they someone who's made a contribution to the business world mm-hmm. or the political world or the music world, like Sir Elton John.
Yeah.
I think he's my favorite knight, if I can say
that. Oh,
I gotta
say, I'm
gonna
show
favoritism.
Oh,
really?
He's my favorite, yeah.
Gosh, I'm gonna stick up for Elton with his,
okay.
you know, little kicky sunglasses and earring. Gosh, I just love him.
Yeah.
So.
And they're a member of the Order of the Garter, which I found really interesting that this was one of the original orders. It was established at least in 1346. You might be wondering why they're called the Order of the Garter. It is an interesting name. And one source I found said that the theory is that Edward III, who started the order, was really interested in the Arthur's Round Table and that whole legend. He wanted to revive it, and he chose the name because of an embarrassing incident where Edward was at a party and he was dancing with a girl, and the girl actually lost her garter and it fell on the floor. And in order to quell the sort of embarrassment, he put it on his leg and he said, "Shame to him who thinks evil of it." So this sort of idea, you know, don't think evil of others, he was really proud of, and that's why he named it the Order of the Garter.
Oh, how about that? That's a sweet story.
Yeah.
I like that. So clearly, there are a lot of different tales and legends surrounding the Order of Knights, and many more knights specifically for you to learn about. So be sure to read all about knights and castles and maybe even an article on dragons on HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.